One of the names that you encountered, so one of the people who offered concrete resistance to your attempts to bring the word out on this, and also an individual whose name cropped up in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal, was Richard Armitage. Could you go into some of your encounters with Armitage, so to speak? Because I'm sure the listeners who know his name from the Iran-Contra scandal would be interested to hear your conflicts with him as you went about trying to expose the truth about the POWs.
Well, what was very interesting from the very beginning was simply that here is a man who had incredible power, who was in charge of covert operations for the Pentagon, and he was also in charge of POWs. And I could not, for the life of me, figure out at the beginning why he would have both those portfolios. And, of course, he took a very strong line in the 60 Minutes interview already that, you know, the government did make this a priority. He gave it a basic lip service, but that there had been no credible evidence. And we know absolutely that that was not true. And he must have known it because he had access to all of the information. So one is left with the really big question of why the man who knew exactly what the credible evidence was, thousands and thousands of documents and reports, and the kind of intelligence that was described by General Tai as being a miracle, you know, where you have seen a man where 25 independent witnesses might have seen a prisoner in the same spot, described him in the same way. 25 different people who had no relationship with each other, who might at the particular point when they were be reporting, living in different parts of the world, one in Hong Kong, some in the United States, some in Canada, some in Paris, who had never asked for any money for the information, who didn't want to move to the United States, who were simply making these reports. And the reports were being made by people who had had intelligence experience, people who had been our allies, who had fought for us, offered their lives for the United States. All those people would make the same report. That's the kind of intelligence we were talking about. And it was described by the man who was in charge as not being credible, as there being no evidence ever since the end of the war of any men being alive. And, you know, that is still the big question. Now, why would a man like that stand in front of a camera and tell that story? You know, I mean, the laws have changed now so that you can't accuse anyone of being a liar, so I won't. But you know, what possessed the man who had all this information to say that? Perhaps it was his great regard for national security.
We shouldn't concentrate too much on individuals, because what I think is very worrisome is that a kind of mentality can take root inside these institutions, and the loyalty is no longer to the American people, it is to the institution. And people become very concerned within those institutions that they not break ranks and say anything that in any way weakens the facade of infallibility that those institutions like to present to the rest of the world. So you get this kind of distorted, perverted sense of loyalty, which is not really to the country at all, it's to one particular bureaucracy. This is the dangerous thing, it's the little men. I remember Issa Harel, the head of the Mossad, Israeli intelligence service, telling me that his greatest disappointment when he arrested Eichmann and bundled him on a plane back to Israel was that Eichmann was in fact just a rather timid little man, and he had built up in his mind, the Mossad chief had built up in his mind an image of a bully in jackboots. And, you know, that goes right to the heart of the matter. The bullies in jackboots don't appear to be bullies in jackboots at all. They're often quite timid little desk-bound warriors who are sitting in their bureaucratic inside their bureaucratic walls, maintaining a loyalty to one another. Higher principle. It's not unlike the things that the private schools in England are accused of doing, the old boy network. It can work against the general wheel of the whole country.
In other words, basically what Hannah Arendt is referring to is the banality of evil. So simply you scratch, bureaucrats scratching each other's backs.
That is exactly how it begins. I used to wonder how it was that the Germans conspired somehow to against themselves. And I realize now that what happened must have been simply that small officials hanging on to their jobs and worried about, for no good reason since they can't get fired, but nevertheless worried about their positions, would just simply keep their heads down and say nothing when they saw something going wrong around them that their moral principles ought to be revolted by.
Also, one of the things that appears to have happened in Nazi Germany, and I've done a great deal of research and reading on the rise of Hitler, and I see a lot of very disturbing parallels between the rise of Hitler and the circumstances that obtained in Germany at the time and what's going on today in the United States. One of the things that lulled an awful lot of Germans of democratic sentiment to sleep was the fact that things happened gradually, that each step that was taken by Hitler was not so much greater than the step before it. So if you didn't protest at the step before it, why protest at this one, or for that matter, the next, or the next, or the next? It's similar to the example of a frog which is dropped in boiling water and will then promptly leap out. But if you place a frog in water at room temperature and slowly turn up the heat underneath it, it will sit there and boil. And I think one of the things that has lulled an awful lot of people in this country to sleep about just how badly our democratic process has been eroded by the national security culture of the post-World War II period is the fact that the erosion has been gradual, although very significant.
But one thing that you do have in this country that encouraged us tremendously and still does, and that you did not have in Germany, is the rest of the country. You know, you don't just have Washington and you don't just have that New York-Washington network. You have really vigorous newspapers all across the country. You have radio stations like this one. You have, well, to a lesser degree, television stations, but you have lively, interested people who want to see something change, and they, I think, are really on the verge of turning this issue around. The network of the families and veterans and interested people alone, the little newsletters that they put out, where no sooner does something appear in a paper in Toronto or in Fort Worth, and it's circulated and everybody is aware of it, and everybody is pushing for the big media to do something as well. And if that can now be translated into pushing Washington, I think with Perestroika, which is probably the best aid toward bringing men home and changing this whole thing, we can see something done.
Well, when Monica's talking about Perestroika, you know, she's referring specifically to recent visits by Vietnam veterans to Russia, where they have been able to get assurances that if they can help to get the names and fate of Russians missing in Afghanistan, the Russians, for their part, will do their best to find out what has happened or turn over. In many cases, they already know the details of what has happened to men missing in the Indochina area.
But the point I was making is that I think one can get too pessimistic. And there is also reason, you know, for being optimistic and for moving forward with this. And we have really seen that. I mean, before I might have given lip service to sort of the grassroots element and what the grassroots element can do, but now I've actually seen it work, and it's tremendously encouraging.
This brings me to something I wanted to ask, and basically, where do we go from here, both in terms of you two personally with regard to this issue? What do you have planned in the future, a second book or television appearances, or what do you have in mind, documentaries, and as far as your own personal investigation of this? And beyond that, what would you recommend to the listeners? And there are quite a few people. This audience in this area has an activist reputation, I guess you could say. I have taken over the years an activist orientation to the audience. I encourage them to call politicians, contact news media, and generally spread the word and do what they can to affect the process. What concrete recommendations would you make to this audience in terms of things they can do to help get the word out, to help publicize the situation, and also perhaps to concretely affect the outcome of the political influences that are involved?
Well, I think, first of all, one very important thing for the kind of audience you do have is to get the word out that this is not just a Rambo issue, and this is not just crazies who are involved in it. involved in it, but that this is really ordinary Americans across the country who are interested in what happens to young men who serve in the armed forces and who are terribly concerned about this abuse of secrecy across the board because they have had first-hand experience with it. I think that your audience can do that probably better than any other, and to get the word out to the newspapers and whatever other media that they have access to. And second of all, what we've mentioned before is to put pressure on their own representatives, their congressmen and senators, first of all for the truth bill, because, you know, although it deals with this specific issue, it's something much larger is at stake. Material like this, anything like this, needs to be declassified so that we know what the intelligence services are doing. And this is probably the best example because, you know, we may not have a right to see all of the intelligence material. Obviously, we don't when it comes to terrorist activities because it really could be terribly damaging. There does need to be some secrecy. But in this instance, Americans have the legal right to know what happened to men who were taken prisoners, especially the families have the right. So that it's a very good way to find out generally how those services operate, how they serve us. So have them get behind the truth bill and also lend their support to continuing this investigation that has just put out the interim report. It's the Senate Foreign Relations Committee minority staff that have done this and calls to their representatives to give support to this will allow that committee to go on to the next much deeper stage. And that's very, very important because what we have now is we know what's wrong, they outline it, but we don't go into all of the specific cases. And that is what needs to be done now.
You know, in Kiss the Boys Goodbye, we tell the story of Bill Casey, the head of the CIA, telling us at the very early stage of his appointment as director of the CIA that he was going to get to the bottom of this whole issue. And the next thing we heard was that it was not a sexy issue. He said this to us, he said this to a number of other people involved in trying to get the whole thing resolved. What he meant by that was that it was not a sexy issue politically. He was a political animal. And the lawmakers in Washington will respond if they think that there is a large number of people in their constituencies who want some answers. Then they will get off their backsides and act. But until that happens, they can get themselves so lost in their own little institution that they forget that there are these larger issues.
But what they would like to have done is to have the prisoner issue resolved, really. And they don't just want bones returned. They would like to have an accounting and a return of the men who are still there. And they're not going to hammer the Vietnamese if that happens and say, we'll never have diplomatic relations again. You know, quite often, soldiers on different sides of a war understand each other better than they understand some people in their own countries. And I think this is what has happened. They are really ready for an opening up of relations, but this is an issue that must be resolved. And I think the Vietnamese understand that as well, just as we're now finding that our former Cold War worst enemy, the Soviet Union, has much in common with us, and we can really sit down and talk to them and each side help the other.
There's a tremendous urgency to this because delay is the greatest single weapon in the hands of any bureaucracy. And the delays have been piling up one after another, and so long as they continue, men are going to die until finally there won't be any living evidence left. And that, I hate to say this, but that is clearly the hope and the intention of those people who do not want the truth to get out, that the man will never get out. So the pressure has to be applied now. What men are left have a very short time ahead of them. For that reason alone, the pressure has to be applied now and public opinion has to make itself heard. The Vietnamese are not quite sure who to believe. Just as recently as A few days ago, Foreign Minister Thach comes over from Hanoi. He gets allowed one day in Washington, and he is talking to a group of people who have been managing the issue, either consciously or unconsciously, including the head of the League of Families, Ann Mills Griffiths, who is clearly on the record committed to defending the government position entirely. So Thach goes back to Hanoi with the impression that all the American people want back are the bones, not the men. And he needs to realize that, in fact, the American public has not been represented by the people he was talking to in these last few days.
And in fact, the Vietnamese have, over the last several years, indicated a great willingness to move forward on this issue. As a matter of fact, we have an internal JCRC report called the MIA Story by John Mather, who headed the Joint Casualty Resolution Center, in which he describes precisely how they offered a year and a half ago to set up a unit of JCRC in Hanoi itself. And there are other examples. A group of senators went over there in 1987, and the Vietnamese said, well, you know, we may not have any directly under our control, but we could help you look for them. And, you know, that, again, was just passed over and dropped. The U.S. government has never taken any kind of official step, whether it was offered by the Vietnamese or not, to ask for those men, to ask for them back officially.
A couple of things, Monica. What is the actual name of the piece of legislation, the truth bill, that you were referring to? Do you know?
It's a House Resolution 3260. I'm not sure about the number now, but it is known as the truth bill.
Okay, H.R. 3260, known as the truth bill.
Yeah, it is the truth bill. I could be wrong on the number right now. It's just left my head. It's getting to be quite late here.
Okay, well, this is one of the reasons I wanted to ask you at this time. It's almost midnight your time, and I want to get some concrete things for people to do here in the audience that would like to pursue this. Now, again, contacting their congressional representative or senator and encouraging them to support the truth bill would be one thing. Now, you said it was Senator Grassley of Iowa who has been very active and spent those hundreds of hours researching this?
Yes, yes. He is the man who has been most directly involved. It is, of course, the Senate Foreign Relations minority staff that has been in charge of this, and the ranking member on that is Jesse Helms, who, whatever position he's taken on other issues, and we're not going to argue that at all, has played a key role in allowing this to go forward. But he and Grassley have worked together on it, but it's Grassley who's done a lot of the legwork and who really was the one who got involved in this at the beginning, made sure that the right investigator was hired by the committee and set it up.
And also, I think people should question write letters to their local newspapers, question their local radio hosts, get some discussion going on it, because it isn't just, as so many people have tended to think, a matter involving a handful of Americans who just happen to be missing in Indochina. It's an issue that goes very much deeper than that. The measures that have been taken to try and stop this issue coming under discussion are totally out of all proportion to the matter of recovering American prisoners. As an example, we've told you about, first of all, the pressure put on Monica with her 60 Minutes piece, then the attempts to try and stop the book getting published, and then once the book was published, attempts that appear to have been made to stop it getting into certain bookstores. We've been getting reports from all over the country from Vietnam veteran organizations very concerned with this issue, telling us that they cannot get Kiss the Boys Goodbye in their local bookstores. Now, the publishers have published a mammoth first publication in terms of numbers, and the books should be available in all the bookstores. But somewhere in the pipeline, there seems to have been some divergences taking place.
One of the things that I think is so potentially explosive about your book is that It not only gets out the facts concerning the large numbers of very credible reports of POWs and MIAs in Southeast Asia, but again, there are aspects of the issue that would be politically sexy, say, for someone like Jesse Helms or someone of that persuasion, and yet at the same time, someone that was concerned with the Iran-Contra scandal, someone that has followed the particulars of the Christic Institute suit or the real investigation into the Iran-Contra scandal as opposed to the very superficial and cursory investigation that Congress undertook, anyone who is familiar with the facts of the Iran-Contra scandal and the cast of characters, so to speak, will see many of those same individuals operating in Southeast Asia. And I think your book, at least to a certain extent, corroborates some of the Christic Institute's allegations concerning activities of the enterprise, quote-unquote, in Southeast Asia. So I think one of the things that makes it so explosive is the potentially wide audience and the large number of normally divergent people who would find common ground if they were to read this book and understand the implications. You would get people within the national security establishment, veterans of the intelligence agencies and the military, as well as progressive political activists who are concerned with the abuse of national security power and covert action, and many of the people that have supported the Christic Institute. And if you could get people of Jesse Helms' persuasion on the one hand and people of the Christic Institute's persuasion on the other to agree on an issue, you could make a lot of political hay with that.
Yeah, and I think we should see an end to this disinformation that is targeted against individuals and against people like Danny Sheehan of the Christic Institute, because when I got involved in this at the beginning, what I was hearing was that the Christic Institute was a left-wing outfit and that Danny Sheehan was irresponsible and so on. And then I met him and saw what he was doing, and that happened accidentally because we were following a trail that crossed his trail, that crossed H. Ross Perot's trail. And I realized that Danny was getting a bum rap. The Christic Institute seemed to me to be doing exactly what it said it was trying to do, which was use the laws of the land to ensure justice. And I see nothing subversive about that at all. We all have an interest in this, whatever political attitudes we may have on specific issues.
What it's really about, the abuses that are described in your book and the ideal situation that, well, or at least the improved situation that we would all, certainly the people listening to this program would like to see, what it's really about is the rule of law, that in a society where there is no law or where the protection of law is flawed, individuals like professional military men, professional intelligencers on the one hand, or journalists or progressive political activists on the other, are ultimately subject to the same abuses of power and the same threats, that the rule of law must be kept intact, otherwise it threatens people of all political persuasions and people in all walks of life.
I couldn't agree with you more. I took the rule of law for granted, and 4 years ago, when I started to see what was happening to Monica and then see what was happening to other people who were, I thought, legitimately raising questions, made me suddenly realize what a precious thing this is and how we've got to constantly make sure that the rule of law does prevail and that it applies to every citizen.
Absolutely. Now, I was wondering if there are some specific institutions or individuals or phone numbers or places to write to that you could give to the audience. In other words, you talked about the League of Families, which is actually a front for various activities by the Pentagon. Are there any legitimate organizations or places that people could write to or a phone in order to get more information or to contribute their efforts to improving the situation?
Well, I think, you know, their own senators and congressmen, that is the first and best example. And the other, you know, if they want to take it beyond that and get involved in this issue specifically, one of the people who's worked closely with us is Captain Red McDaniel. He was a prisoner for 6 years, and he heads the American Defense Institute, which normally is involved with things like registering for votes, men in the services. But he is a good one. He's very knowledgeable about the overall issue, and he knows, you know, what further activities people can get involved in.
In fact, Red is probably one of the one of the best people to direct inquiries to, because I've watched Red go through this whole terrible cycle. He came out of the Hanoi Hilton, probably the most tortured of prisoners. He'd been shot down on his 84th mission. He became the commander of an aircraft carrier and then became liaison on Capitol Hill for the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Navy. Highly decorated, had the Navy's highest decorations. And until the early 1980s, simply believed what he was told, that all the prisoners who came home in 1973 were all the prisoners that existed. And then, because of his particular background, he had access to intelligence, and he saw satellite photographs that he himself was absolutely convinced indicated there were prisoners on the ground, American prisoners. And it transformed him. From that stage, he's moved forward until he's got to the point where we are, of questioning the whole business industry of intelligence and security and covert operations and all the little spin-offs, the special centers for strategic studies that are really continuing to propagandize on behalf of secret intelligence and so on. Red McDaniel is still a stout Republican who believes in his country and in a strong defense, but he also is today very well informed on how these things can all be threatened by this abuse of secrecy. The other, going to the other side, a voluntary organization like the Christic Institute, I think does deserve everybody's support. And I say that in the full knowledge that there are people on Capitol Hill on both sides who think of the Christic Institute, because they've been bombarded with this kind of propaganda, as being somehow a radical organization that is trying to hurt the country, when in fact it is one of the few organizations that is passionately attempting to defend the country's freedoms.
It's also,
I have the American Defense Institute's address and telephone number. Do you want us to say that?
Yes, why don't you go ahead and do that? And again,
it's American Defense Institute and Foundation, 214 Massachusetts Avenue, Northeast, Post Office Box 2497, Washington, D.C., 20013-2497. And the telephone number is area code 202-544-4704.
Okay, well, why don't you go over it one more time, Monica, for people that are writing it down.
Okay. 214 Massachusetts Avenue, Northeast, Post Office Box 2497, Washington, D.C., 20013-2497. Telephone number 202-544-4704.
Okay, and again, that's...
That is the address of the American Defense Foundation, and that is headed by Navy Captain Eugene Red McDaniel,
who was one of the principal figures in Kiss the Boys Goodbye and one of the major informants for the Stevensons on the issue.
Major source of our material.
Right, exactly. And again, I want to reiterate for the benefit of the listening audience that the whole idea, the whole issue of POWs and MIAs in Southeast Asia has been given the Rambo Chuck Norris spin by the major news media. Obviously, it is an issue of great importance to people within the professional military and intelligence ranks. Upon reading the book, anyone familiar with, again, the Christic Institute material, or anyone who has investigated the abuses of the U.S. intelligence agencies over the last quarter of a century will see many of the names and elements that figure prominently in those abuses. And it's an issue that is of interest to people who want to see the covert state, the covert action establishment reined in, if not overturned altogether. Because it appears to me that this book corroborates to a considerable extent at least some of the material from the Christic Institute's affidavit about the activities of the Enterprise in Southeast Asia. And it's not the right-wing issue that it's been made out to be in the general news media.
No, not at all. You know, what interested me about it as things progressed was that I suddenly realized that it was a legitimate way of examining the performance of the intelligence services. We've had to take them on trust. We have to believe them when they say that they have succeeded and scored great successes but cannot talk about them for secrecy reasons. And we have to take them at their word that they've had no failures. This is one time when the ordinary American citizen has the absolute right to demand to see exactly what has been done on behalf of Americans who went to war a long distance away and who did not come back. And in doing that, one is able to make an assessment of just how competent or incompetent these services are. Now that seems to me to cut right across all political lines.
And beyond that, it's again the story of the abuses of institutional power that figure at all so many different levels in your book, both the people who are actually over in Southeast Asia, people like Scott Barnes or Jerry Daniels, who experienced abuses of power of one sort or another, and then the people like yourselves and other people within the journalistic and research community that have attempted to bring out the truth and have faced institutional repression of various kinds, like getting books prevailing on bookstores not to carry books and things of that kind. It seems to me that this is of central interest to anyone who's concerned with democracy in this country.
Absolutely. And can I just insert one thing, because I feel terrible about having forgotten it before. The truth bill is House Resolution 3603.
House Resolution 3603.
Right.
Okay, and as I recall, the number in Washington, D.C., I believe it's 224-3121 in the 202 area code, just going off the top of my head. That is the Capitol switchboard, so people who would like to contact their congressional representatives and senators, again, 202-224-3121 is the phone number, as I recall. So it seems to me to be a good place to wind things up. It's after midnight your time, or actually, yeah, it's after midnight.
That's right.
In Toronto, so you guys are going to have to retreat to the land of Morpheus. I just want to tell you that I think that, by way of conclusion, I think this is a very important and brilliant book, and I think the two of you deserve a lot of credit for not only the perseverance to bring this story out, but frankly, the physical courage and personal integrity to stick with what must have been a pretty thankless task at times, at least.
Thank you very much.
And I think it's a profound act of citizenship and a profound act of democracy to pursue this issue the way you have. And for my part, I'm going to do what I can to generate publicity about it, because I think it is, again, it's something that is of interest to a wide persuasion of Americans, with people of very different backgrounds and very different outlooks. Will find a lot that is important in your book, and I want to wish you all the luck in the world and all the success in the world in overcoming the resistance you face so far and getting the story out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, listen, stay in touch, and I will be in touch with you and communicate with you about further information.
Okay, good night.
Okay, good night now. All righty, well, that winds things up for the interview with Monica Jensen-Stevenson and William Stevenson, respectively, the authors of the current book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye, How America Betrayed Its POWs, Its Own POWs in Vietnam. They were live via phone hookup from Toronto. I'm going to read you Warren Hinkle's column from Thursday, October 25th of 1990, in the San Francisco Examiner of that date. Again, this is number 23, column number 23 in Hinkle's excellent ongoing series called George Bush and the Drug Wars. And this specifically talks about the book Kiss the Boys Goodbye, again by Monica Jensen-Stevenson and William Stevenson, who we just heard for a couple of hours from Toronto. This might seem like gilding the lily, perhaps, or might seem a little repetitive, but I'm going to go ahead and read Hinkle's column, and for people that might have come in the middle of the discussion, or for people that might have gotten lost at somewhere along the line, perhaps, I don't know how skilled my interview was, how comprehensible the information was. So I'm going to go ahead and read this Examiner column, and it'll give you a good summation of what is in the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And again, the whole issue of POWs and MIAs has been made out to be a right wing, or it has been the political football for the right wing. It has been an issue which has been obscured by the Rambo Chuck Norris mystique. And in fact, the significance of this book, as I mentioned, is that it goes right to the core of that group of operatives that is termed by the Christic Institute the secret team, and there is considerable intersection between elements of the Christic's affidavit and information developed by the Christic Institute and information developed by the Stevensons in their book. Hinkle has entitled his column, again, San Francisco Examiner, Thursday, October 25th of 1990, Has CIA Concealed American POWs? Well, George, I go in looking for prisoners, but I spend all my time discovering the government has been moving drugs around the world and is involved in illegal arms deals. I can't get at the prisoners because of the corruption among our own covert people. Ross Perot on his search for American POWs in Southeast Asia to then Vice President George Bush in 1987. The main body of Hinkle's column reads as follows. William Webster was sworn in as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency on May 26, 1987. He selected from all the spook books in the CIA library Bill Stevenson's A Man Called Intrepid as the text for his inaugural sermon. It is the story of the ace Brit spymaster Sir William Stevenson, codenamed Intrepid. The new CIA boss sought to inspire his troops with Intrepid's uplifting dictum that intelligence work requires men of great integrity because when you operate in absolute secrecy, free from most rules of behavior, abuse comes easily. Spycraft expert Stevenson is a veteran Southeast Asia war correspondent who has always been on close professional terms and generally admiring of the intelligence services of Great Britain, Israel, and the United States. He was a welcome guest at the CIA's Sylvan headquarters in rural Langley, Virginia. The CIA no longer sets a place for Bill Stevenson at its table. Stevenson, in a recent book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, co-written by his wife, a former producer for 60 Minutes, has reluctantly concluded that the CIA behaved in a beastly fashion toward American POWs still captive in Southeast Asia after the Vietnam Peace Accords of 1973. Stevenson says the CIA continued a secret anti-communist war in Indochina after 1973, so secret from congressional scrutiny that some of its activities were financed by profits from drug profiteering. Because a full-scale effort to free POWs might expose the agency's clandestine networks in Laos and Cambodia, Stevenson says the CIA abused its secrecy privileges by concealing solid intelligence reports about captured Americans still alive in Southeast Asia. Even recently, CIA personnel assigned to investigate reports of missing American servicemen were used as cover for recruiting and arming refugees to fight on the side of the genocidal Khmer Rouge against the Hanoi-supported government in Cambodia, said Stevenson. As late as November of 1989, there was a credible report of 20 American POWs still alive in Vietnam. Stevenson said it was ignored because it might embarrass the Bush administration. The author has concluded that the CIA is not the model of decorous behavior for the silent services that he once considered it. The whole story, including the abuse of secrecy by some intelligence officials he believes were profiting from the CIA-connected Asian drug traffic, would, quote, just about destroy the agency if an honest investigation were held, unquote, he said. Whether the government abandoned American servicemen in its messy exodus from Vietnam is a highly contentious issue. The Nixon administration, in its haste, agreed with the North Vietnamese in 1973 about the number of POWs held and wrote off those missing in action, more than 2,000 men, as dead. Henry Kissinger insisted in the mid-1970s that no American servicemen were alive in Vietnam, except perhaps for some traitors, quote-unquote. Stevenson is no newcomer to the satanic prisoner-of-war policies of the Vietnamese communists. As a reporter for the Toronto Star, he covered the French defeat in Vietnam in 1954. He interviewed Ho Chi Minh at length and wrote a book about him, but was later barred from North Vietnam for reporting that imprisoned French soldiers had not become, quote, re-educated converts to communism, as the Vietnamese claimed, but were only holding the little red book with a gun to their backs. Stevenson learned the cash-and-carry Vietnamese attitude to prisoners, they called them pearls, and kept many of their French prisoners for more than a decade, and then exchanged them for king's ransoms. The Vietnamese logic was that a POW's value improved with age. It thus did not seem improbable to Stevenson that American POWs might still be held in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos even into the 1980s. Stevenson returned to Hanoi in the autumn of 1988 to interview the legendarily mean Trong Chinh, C-H-I-N-H, the late Ho's all-powerful deputy whose penchant for vengeance against Americans was well known. Their conversation was conducted in the half-light of a lone lantern. The old communist was slumped in an armchair in Ho's study. "Can I speak with the Americans?" Stevenson asked him. There was a long silence. Such a question was dangerous because the North Vietnamese leadership had declared that there was not a single American being held in their country. Finally, Trong answered, quote, "It is possible we shall embarrass the American government someday by sending some back," unquote. What surprised Stevenson was the vehemence and bitterness with which American officials badmouthed and smeared Vietnam vets, the families of MIAs, and retired military men of rank whose consciences wouldn't let them live a lie when they knew that the CIA and the Pentagon had up-to-date intelligence on the location of American prisoners declared dead. Quote, "It was like watching a herd of Gestapo going around badgering American families of missing servicemen when they should have been helping them," unquote, he said. Stevenson was dragooned into the POW controversy by his wife, Monica Jensen Stevenson, who had produced a 60-minute segment on POWs and encountered extreme government hostility for raising questions about whether some might still be alive. The couple spent 5 years pursuing the story. Their book is a classic study of disillusionment within the CIA, disillusionment with the CIA and its working relationships with drug traffickers. As Cold War adventurism was given primacy in American foreign policy over the goals of the war on drugs, covert action, and the secrets of the CIA's continuing wars in Southeast Asia were considered more important than efforts to release POWs. Let me read that last sentence again. As Cold War adventurism was given primacy in American foreign policy over the goals of the war on drugs, covert action and the secrets of the CIA's continuing wars in Southeast Asia were considered more important than efforts to release POWs. The POW issue has never been popular with American liberals who otherwise rushed to question the CIA because it was an issue that early on became a cause of the American right. One of the loudest critics of government cover-ups of POW information is Senator Jesse Helms. Ronald Reagan embraced the cause by appointing Texas billionaire Ross Perot to investigate the fate of Vietnam MIAs. But Perot took the assignment more seriously than the Reagan-Bush administration apparently intended. When he got hard evidence of at least some POWs still alive in Southeast Asia and found his search blocked by American intelligence officials involved in drug trafficking, Perot complained to a former CIA director, Vice President George Bush. As soon as Bush realized where Perot was coming from, The billionaire told the Stevensons he was dropped like a hot stone by the administration. Stevenson says that many of those abandoned, quote-unquote, in Southeast Asia by the United States were captured in CIA wars in Laos and Cambodia. To rescue them, the government might have had to reveal ongoing clandestine activities, so it left them to rot. The secret wars in Laos and Cambodia, in Cambodia the fight continues, reaped the destruction of Cambodian society and the virtual extinction of the Hmong people of Laos. It also apparently sowed the ground for abandoning the POWs. A Thai intelligence official said to Bill Stevenson of the American military men missing in Southeast Asia, "Their families kissed them goodbye, but your government kissed them off," unquote. And again, this is a very important book and a very significant issue, and not one whose significance should be gleaned from the way it's been portrayed in the major media. As I say, the whole POW issue has been a political football kicked around by the far right, and it's gotten the Rambo Chuck Norris play. But in fact, there appear to be considerable elements of the information developed by the Stevensons in their book which corroborate much of what is said by the Sheehan affidavit by the Christic Institute concerning the Enterprise, quote-unquote, the secret team and their activities in Southeast Asia. That's not primarily what the Stevenson's book is about, but that's an important element of it, and I think it's a very important book to read. And beyond that, it's very important, I think, to generate publicity about this, because it is, as I said during the interview, a book which could focus the attentions of a lot of different people of very different political persuasions and might provide some very important common ground for action.